Chapter 31. After 3 weeks on the continent, Echo was tired and homesick and missed his family. He had scouted a tournament in Cape Town, attended conferences in Accra and Nairobi, and watched a dozen games with coaching friends in Senegal, Cameroon, and Nigeria. He'd logged 8,000 miles between countries and spent Thanksgiving Day stranded in an airport in Accra, the capital of Ghana. But he had one more stop, one that he could not, in good conscience, blow off, though he desperately wanted to. He landed in Kampala and was met at the airport by an old friend named Nestor Kim, a coach of the Ugandan national team. Kim's brother ranked high in the government and knew which strings to pull. Early the next morning, they drove to Entebbe International Airport and were directed to the cargo field far away from the main terminal. There they met a smartly dressed officer named Joseph something or other. Echo could neither pronounce nor spell the man's last name, so he simply called him Sir. Joseph seemed to expect this. They piled into his jeep and circled around two long, wide airstrips lined with taxiways choked with cargo planes, some waiting to take off, others landing. Surrounding the runways were endless rows of huge military tents shielding tons of crates of food. Joseph parked his jeep by an administration building, and they hopped out. He glanced at his watch and said,
"Your flight leaves in about an hour, but nothing runs on time. There's a 50-50 chance you can get on it, so don't be disappointed if you don't. We won't know until the last minute. It's all about weight and balance."
He waved at the chaos and asked,
"Want a quick tour?"
Echo and Kim nodded. "Sure, why not?" The tents were in a large grid and separated by gravel drives. Cargo trucks and forklifts bustled about as hundreds of workers loaded and unloaded the crates. Joseph stopped and waved an arm. Before them were the tents. Behind them, airplane engines roared as they took off, while dozens more waited. Joseph said,
"We're feeding 1 million refugees a day, and they're scattered throughout the country in about 50 settlements. Some are easy to get to, some almost impossible. All are overcrowded and taking in more people every day. It's a terrible humanitarian crisis, and we're barely hanging on. What you see here is a frantic effort by our government and the United Nations. Most of this food comes from the UN, but there's also a lot from the NGOs. Right now, we're working with about 30 relief organizations from around the world. Some bring their own airplanes. Some of these are from our Air Force, others from the UN. At certain times of the day, this is the busiest airport in the world, for what that's worth."
Echo asked, "How far away is Rhino Camp?"
"An hour, give or take. There's a Danish group that flies from here to Rhino 4 times a day, and I'm trying to squeeze you on board. If that fails, we'll try another one. As you can see, there are plenty of planes."
It was a stunning assemblage of aircraft, almost all twins and turboprops, short-field workhorses, built for narrow and uneven dirt strips. On the ground, they zigged and zagged their way from the warehouses to the taxiways where they fell in long lines and waited. On the other runway, a steady stream of the same planes landed every 30 seconds and wheeled onto the nearest taxiway. Every takeoff and landing created another boiling cloud of dust. The runways were asphalt and could handle the biggest jets, but the connecting roads were dirt and gravel. A mile away, in a much more civilized part of the airport, commercial flights came and went at a leisurely pace. They watched the show for a few minutes, and Joseph said,
"As you might guess, traffic control is a nightmare, ground and air, but we do okay. Haven't had a fender bender in over a month." "How safe are the flights?"
Echo asked. Joseph smiled and asked,
"Getting a bit nervous, are we?"
"Of course not."
"Well, we can fly only in good weather. These planes are headed to the bush, where only a handful of towns have proper runways and traffic control. Most are going to dirt strips with no navigational support. So what you see here are some of the best pilots in the world. They can fly in all kinds of weather, but often they can't land, so we ground them when it rains."
"Where are the pilots from?"
"Half are from our Air Force. The other half come from around the world. A lot of UN guys, and a surprising number of women. To answer your question, we haven't had a crash in 7 months.
7 months seemed like an awfully short period of time to Echo, but he firmed up his jaw as if he had no fear. There was no turning back, anyway. He'd made a promise to Samuel. Joseph's radio squawked, and he excused himself. Echo and Kim retreated to the safety of a warehouse tent, and in the shade watched the incredible, organized chaos before them. Joseph was back, driving his Jeep, and he barked,
"Get in! Let's go!"
They weaved through the grid and were soon lost in a cluster of tents. When they emerged, there were three identical turboprops with workers stuffing boxes inside. On each tail was the name of the non-profit, something in a foreign language, but under it, in small print, was Denmark. Joseph approached one of the pilots, evidently a Dane, and said the magic words. He looked at Echo and Kim and waved them over. As they crawled on board and settled into the cramped seats just behind the pilots, Joseph said,
"Good luck, lads. I'll see you when you get back. If you make it."
They strapped in and began to sweat in the stifling humidity. A ramp boy closed the door, and the pilots began flipping switches. Echo and Kim watched them with fascination. As the turboprop began to taxi, the co-pilot opened his window and a fresh wave of hot air blew in. The line was slow, but steady. Though he was nervous about the flight, Echo was thrilled with the adventure and was once again pleased with his decision not to tell his wife about this little side trip. He would describe it all when he got home. From 10,000 feet, the Ugandan countryside was beautiful, and Echo absorbed it all. He was struck by the lack of roads and the remoteness of the villages, and he was once again grateful that his parents had settled in America. Behind them were three large crates of food, with smaller boxes crammed into every available space. The plane rattled, shook, and vibrated, and this never ceased. Remarkably, he caught himself dozing off. The descent became interesting when Echo and Kim had their first glimpse of the runway. From 3,000 feet, it appeared to be nothing more than a pig trail hacked out of the middle of a forest. Huts from a nearby village could be seen, but there were no other signs of civilization. On final approach, the co-pilot turned around and yelled,
"Hang on!"
This was not comforting. The landing was a hard slam dunk that caused Echo to dig his fingernails into the left knee of his co-passenger. When they could breathe again, they managed to laugh. Every successful landing is a good one. Two cargo trucks were waiting at a small metal building that housed racks of food and water. When the engines died, a crew of teenage boys yanked open the rear doors and began unloading the crates. Within minutes, the trucks were loaded and the plane's engines restarted. The pilots waved goodbye and taxied out. The truck driver was another Dane. He introduced himself with a big smile and told them to get in the cab. Half of the grounds crew hopped on board and settled among the cargo. Rhino Camp was half an hour away. Echo's first look at it caused him to shake his head in disbelief. Tents and shanties stretched for miles, and thousands of refugees, most of them his people, South Sudanese, walked the dirt roads, seemingly going nowhere. The truck stopped at a distribution point where other trucks were arriving and unloading. A Ugandan army private was waiting for them, and they immediately left on foot. Echo carried a small gym bag filled with supplies and gifts. For almost an hour, they walked through the settlement, passing countless refugees milling about with nothing to do. They passed long lines of women and children waiting patiently for the next meal, and more lines of people outside clinics and makeshift huts where relief workers filled out forms and handed over food, medicines, and secondhand clothing. They passed hundreds of women and teenage girls walking elegantly with pots of water balanced precariously on their heads. At the Doctors Without Borders hospital, they asked around and found Christine Moran, who led them to a small exam room where Echo finally said hello to Beatrice and her sons. Chol and James were nattily attired in their spotless school uniforms, though they were skipping classes on this special day. From the gym bag, Echo pulled out T-shirts and caps adorned with the NC Central lettering and logos, eagles everywhere. He handed Beatrice an envelope with a long handwritten letter from Samuel and a smaller one with cash. For James and Chol, there were colorful Christmas cards signed by the Eagles players and coaches. They talked for an hour about Samuel and his new life on campus, his classes, his friends, his basketball. On his cell phone, Echo showed them a video of Samuel and his roommate, Murray Walker, as they sent along their love and Christmas greetings. Another video was of Samuel slamming dunks in practice. Kim took dozens of photos with Echo's cell phone. 6 hours later, the empty Danish cargo plane landed at dark at the Entebbe airport, and Echo said thanks and goodbye to Kim. As he waited 3 hours for his flight to Nairobi, Echo sent the photos to Samuel. Roaming the terminal, killing time, he vowed to do whatever he could to rescue the family, though he was well aware of the long odds against it. He called Samuel and they talked for half an hour, expensive minutes on the international plan. He loved the photos and wanted to know everything about his mother and brothers. Echo walked a fine line between being honest about their living conditions and giving the kid some reason to be hopeful. Down three players due to curfew violations, and including a redshirt freshman, the Eagles rode the bus to the campus of Furman in Upper South Carolina for a Wednesday night game. Coach Britt played all nine, and nine were not enough. The Eagles lost by 15 to go 3-5. Mercifully, there were no games for the next week as the schedule broke for exams. Chapter 32. Early Friday morning, December 18th, the team once again loaded onto a charter bus for the 4-hour ride to Washington, D.C. The mood was light. Exams were over. The Christmas break was just around the corner. One more game and they would be off for a few days, and all the players, except Samuel, would go home to their families. Inside the Beltway, he replayed his last trip to the Capitol, back in August when he had spent 2 days with his South Sudanese teammates as they licked their wounds from the showcase tournament in Orlando. Those had been painful days for him, the shock still fresh from the news from home. 4 months later, his life had changed dramatically. But not a minute passed when he didn't think of his late father and the indescribable fate of his beloved sister. His teammates were excited as their bus inched through central D.C., and subdued as he was, Samuel tried his best to smile and go along. The team checked into the Hyatt near Capital One Arena, had a quick lunch, then reboarded the bus for a few hours of sightseeing. At 6, they changed into practice gear and drove to the campus of Howard University for a 1-hour shoot-around. At 8, they walked 4 blocks to a restaurant and were greeted by Maria Manabol from the Embassy of the Republic of South Sudan. She had met Samuel and Coach Britt, along with Echo, in August at the embassy and confirmed Ayak's death. She had also handled the paperwork to facilitate Samuel's student visa, and since then she had monitored his immigration file. She had called him every other week to make sure he was acclimating to college life. She and her husband, Paul, an American from Pittsburgh, were gracious hosts and welcomed the team to a private dining room where they feasted on prime rib with all the trimmings. After dinner, she spoke briefly about her country and its challenges. She did not mention the plight of the Suleiman family, though everyone in the room knew their story. The team was in bed by 11, with strict instructions to sleep as late as possible Saturday morning. Brunch was at 10:30. In spite of its usual role of being the early season patsy for bigger programs, Howard had lost only 2 games and had won 10, including a double overtime upset across town at Maryland. Preseason, the Bison had been lowballed by the experts, who ranked them near the bottom of the Mideastern Athletic Conference. Central was predicted higher, but Vegas thought otherwise and put the Eagles on the board as a 4-point underdog. 2 hours before the 3 p.m. tip-off at Burr Gymnasium, Maria and Paul sat in the stands with Samuel and talked about life in general, life on campus, basketball, and, most important, life in the refugee camps. The embassy received many requests from South Sudanese living in the States to find and try to help displaced relatives back home. Maria had been thrilled when Samuel called with the news that Beatrice and his brothers had been located at Rhino Camp in Uganda. That was no small miracle. Getting them out would take a more significant one. With diplomatic skill, she repeated the warnings Samuel already knew. Immigration was strictly controlled, and few from their country made it. And there were many, many applicants ahead of them. His family had no U.S. sponsor, except for Samuel, and his citizenship was still in doubt. When it was time to get dressed, he thanked her and Paul, gave them big hugs, and promised to keep in touch. Leaving, he said,
"When we come back next season, I'll be on the court."
"We can't wait," she said. As Lonnie and the coaches feared, the one-week layoff proved disastrous. That plus the trip to the big city and the Eagles were completely out of sync. Howard was not. The Bison hit their first five shots and Central couldn't buy a basket. With 12 minutes to go in the second half and up by 24, Howard began subbing freely, and the guys from the bench proved just as hot as the starters. Lonnie cleared his bench too, and everyone played but Samuel. To make matters worse, with 3 minutes to go, Harry Greenwood, a backup forward, limped off the court with what he thought was a twisted knee. X-rays would later reveal torn ligaments that would require surgery. Losing the first conference game by 31 was not exactly the blazing start Coach Britt had in mind. He and the other coaches huddled in the front of the bus, and for 4 hours sulked and whispered and shook their heads. It was another quiet ride home, another retreat after an embarrassing loss. In the locker room at the Nest, Coach Britt wished them all a Merry Christmas, sent them home for the holidays, and made them promise to return in a week with a renewed commitment. A new season would begin, and he claimed to be optimistic. Chapter 33. On Sunday morning, as the dorms closed, Murray and Samuel stuffed their backpacks and duffels and hauled their dirty laundry to the Walker home 10 minutes away. Murray timed their 10:15 arrival perfectly. His parents would be leaving for church, and he had no desire to go with them. Sully said he needed a break, too. Secretly, he was baffled by their Protestant worship and often attended Mass alone. To their pleasant surprise, Miss Ida had decided to cook instead and said she needed the morning off. She welcomed her boys with big hugs and chocolate waffles. As Ernie fried bacon, she showed them around the house and bragged on her Christmas decorations. The colorful tree was the tallest one Samuel had ever seen. He was delighted at the thought of hanging around the warm house for the next few days, eating huge meals, sleeping at all hours, and, most inviting, spending time with Jordan, who would arrive on Monday night. "You're still growing," Miss Ida said at one point, as she checked him out from head to toe. "How much do you weigh?"
210.
She playfully tapped his chest and said,
"You look thicker in the shoulders."
Murray said,
"He lives in the weight room, Mom. He's gained 20 pounds this semester. Thinks he's playing football."
Samuel laughed and said,
"Well, I'm sure not playing basketball."
"That makes two of us,"
Murray said, and managed a laugh, but it was forced. He wasn't playing much, and his frustration was growing. Samuel listened to his complaints and tried to encourage him, but losing pollutes an entire locker room, and there was some dissension. Privately, Samuel was of the opinion that 10 minutes a game was about what his roommate deserved. He had gained exactly 22 pounds since August. Between the weight room, the long dinners at Miss Ida's table, and a wide-open training table, Samuel was adding pounds, and most of it appeared to be muscle. On two occasions, in practice, Coach Britt had quizzed him about off-court workouts. Although he preferred his players lean and flexible, he found it hard to quarrel with the sculpted biceps and thicker legs. Plus, he was only a redshirt, barely 18 years old, and Lonnie decided to let him pump as much iron as he wanted. Sully now stood 78.5 inches tall, and the added height and weight had not slowed him down. He was easily the fastest and quickest on the team, and his vertical leap was up to an astonishing 46 inches. During the long bus ride back from D.C., one of the assistants, Ron McCoy, had broached the subject of jettisoning the redshirt business and given the kid some minutes.
What was the benefit in waiting? The season could not get much worse. Lonnie listened without much of a protest and promised to discuss it later. With two injured, the roster was down to 11 players. One was a redshirt freshman. One was a walk-on who had trouble scoring in practice. After a languid brunch, Ernie and the boys cleaned the kitchen, then settled into the den for a long afternoon of NFL playoffs. Watching football with Sully was painful because he wouldn't shut up. He questioned everything about the game and seemed to absorb none of it. Miss Ida left them to go shopping. At 7, Wednesday morning, Samuel eased through the kitchen and waited in the garage for the weekly call from Christine Moran. It came 15 minutes late, and she explained that their phone system was not working properly and minutes were scarce. Could he please limit the call to 10 minutes? He said sure and thanked her as always, then heard the soft voice of his mother.
Merry Christmas, Samuel.
Merry Christmas to you, Mother. How are you? He closed his eyes and shook his head and wondered how anyone living in a tent in a refugee camp could possibly think about passing along season's greetings. He could not imagine how hopeless and depressing the holidays must be, and he could not help but think of their last Christmas together as a family. She said James and Chol were doing well in school and still talking about Coach Echo Lamb's surprise visit the week before. They were proudly wearing their Central caps and T-shirts and were the envy of the neighborhood. The fact that their older brother was in America playing basketball gave them an elevated status. Beatrice promised to say a prayer for Samuel during Christmas Mass, and he promised to remember them, too. He couldn't forget them, and told his mother he thought of them every minute of the day. The call was too brief, and when it ended, Samuel sat in a lawn chair in the darkness and longed for his family. Their church was packed for the Christmas Eve service, a remarkable celebration that Samuel enjoyed. The preacher throttled back and gave a shorter sermon. The youth group, in full costume, performed a nativity skit. The children's choir, in matching burgundy robes, stole the show with their carols. The adult choir rattled the windows with Go Tell It on the Mountain and The Holy Baby. Jordan explained to Samuel, in a whisper, that the songs had been handed down by generations of African Americans. Late the next morning, the family gathered around the tree and exchanged gifts. The pile included clothes for the boys, jeans and casual shirts for school, and perfume and a gold necklace for Jordan. Samuel's big gift was a navy blazer, his first. Jordan gave him a beautiful necktie. He was overwhelmed by their generosity and almost speechless at the number of gifts. He had managed to save a few bucks and had surprises of his own, a bottle of perfume for Miss Ida, a large chef's apron for Ernie, a leather belt for Murray, and, for Jordan, a set of small earrings that she immediately put on. They were touched by his thoughtfulness and felt guilty for receiving the gifts, but they did nothing to dampen his spirits. By the time the gifts were all finally unwrapped, they were famished. Jordan put on a CD of Christmas songs as the family moved to the kitchen where every walker tried to assume command. Chapter 34. The holiday break came to a dreadful end the day after Christmas when the players dragged themselves back to campus for what was expected to be a painful 3-hour practice. The coaches were waiting like drill sergeants. Coach Britt's speech began with the unnecessary reminder that they were off to a less than impressive start. 3 wins against pushovers and 6 losses, 2 of which should have been avoided. They were better than Campbell, and he took responsibility for that loss. They had a good East Carolina team on the ropes and let them escape. The embarrassing blowout at Howard was inexcusable. After a 15-minute smackdown, he changed his tone and insisted that they put their losses behind them. They had 21 games left, 17 in conference, 9 of those were at home. The games that mattered were ahead of them, and they would waste no more time thinking about their slow start. The players were with him, but they were also thinking of more pressing matters. On Monday, they would fly to New York City for the rare treat of playing in a holiday tournament against other HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities.
The games would be at Madison Square Garden, and most would be televised on one of the ESPN channels. Over a 5-day span, Central would play Grambling from Louisiana, Prairie View from Texas, and Fisk from Nashville. Lonnie talked about the trip, the tournament, and their opponents, all of whom had winning records. In late November, Fisk had manhandled Howard in Washington, on the same court where Central had laid an egg only a week earlier. But enough of the past. His scouting report portrayed the three teams as virtually unbeatable, of near NBA proportions. It was part pep talk, part fear-mongering, and it left the players unsettled. But they were headed to a big show and were determined to play well. When he blew the whistle, they hit the court to stretch and limber up, and then they started running. Their coaches seemed determined to sweat out all the turkey and dressing, pecan pies, fudge brownies, Christmas cakes, and the rest of Grandma's holiday cooking. 15 minutes into the wind sprints, the first player vomited. Driving to the gym, Murray said that he needed to see Robin, and would it be okay if Sully got lost after practice? They needed the privacy of the dorm room. Sully said, sure. He had never said no. Then Murray went on about how nice it would be if she could sleep over. There was a sofa in the commons on their dorm's first floor, and, well, what do you say, roommate? Sully smiled and shrugged and said, whatever. After the grueling practice, the players slowly undressed, showered, changed, and left. They would be back the following day for more of the same. Sully doubted if any of them had the energy for sex. But Murray did, evidently. He offered a ride, but Sully said he would walk. Have some fun and see you in the morning. As the managers cleaned up the locker room, Sully hid in a storage closet. When the lights were off and everyone was gone, he eased back to the court, turned on one light, and began shooting. After 500 shots, he turned off the light and returned to the locker room. He showered again and, for dinner, found a sports drink and some granola bars in the team kitchen. He settled into one of the nice, cushioned chairs in the cramped room where they watched film and turned on an NBA game. By the second quarter, he was sound asleep. He awoke to SportsCenter, watched some highlights, and realized he was starving. He put on a Central sweatsuit and went in search of food. The student cafeteria was still closed, so he left campus. He walked a mile to a soul food cafe, his favorite, and inhaled 2 large chicken biscuits. He toyed with the idea of walking another mile to Sacred Heart for Mass, but decided against it. The weather was raw and threatening, and he would never get accustomed to the cold. When Coach Britt arrived early in the afternoon, he heard the familiar thumping of a basketball. He looked around a corner of the bleachers and saw what he expected. Samuel Suleiman, firing away, shirt off, covered in sweat. 2 things were clear. The kid was growing into quite a physical specimen, and the shots were no longer bouncing off the rim. Practice began with the game plan for Grambling, their first opponent in New York. The players were excited and energetic, though Murray seemed a step or two slower. As always, Sully was relentless in the drills and scrimmage. He was physical to the point of getting hard looks from his teammates. He smiled and yelled and never stopped talking smack. His excitement, though, waned at times. He would not make the trip to New York. Chapter 35. At 9 sharp Monday morning, Coach Britt walked into the locker room and inspected his troops. All were wearing navy blazers, white shirts, khaki pants, and casual shoes, no sneakers. He liked what he saw and tried to insult each one as he examined them. The excitement was palpable and everyone was ready to go. He lined up the 4 student managers, went through their equipment checklists, and for good measure barked at Coach McCoy because he was not wearing a tie. One was quickly put on. Sully sat in a corner in practice garb, watching the show and trying not to appear too deflated. The players spoke to him and got a smile, but they knew he was crushed because he would not make the trip. An appointment with an immigration officer was more important. When all was ready, They filed out of the gym and into a waiting charter bus where the four coaches' wives were waiting in their Sunday best, all chatting eagerly about the trip. Two of them, and one of the coaches, had never seen the Big Apple. 30 minutes later, the bus deposited the group at the private terminal at Raleigh-Durham Airport. Their nonstop flight was scheduled to land at Teterboro in New Jersey just after 2 p.m. With the gym deserted, Sully turned on a couple of lights and began shooting. That night, Murray called with the news that they had arrived safely, and the two talked half an hour about the trip, the hotel, and the vastness of Manhattan. After the call, Sully sat in his bed with the lights off and scanned dozens of photos his teammates were posting. He had never felt so alone. At 9 the next morning, Miss Ida was waiting on schedule in front of the dorm when Samuel walked out. He was wearing his new clothes, navy blazer, khakis, white shirt, and the lovely tie Jordan had given him for Christmas. He had never worn a tie before, and Murray had spent an hour teaching him the proper knot. He had practiced 100 times. Miss Ida inspected him and was quite impressed. They got in her car and she drove 30 minutes to the Raleigh field office of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Their 10 o'clock appointment with a case manager was so important that the date and time could not be moved. Both Miss Ida and Sully had tried to reschedule so he could make the trip to New York with the team, but they had not been successful. There was an enormous backlog of cases. The USCIS offices were understaffed, and so on. Sully was desperate to push along his quest for citizenship, and besides, he wasn't going to play basketball anyway. They spent an hour sitting on folding chairs in a crowded hallway and watched foreigners come and go. At 11:15, Samuel's name was called, and he and Miss Ida were directed to a small corner office where they were greeted by a pleasant young man who apologized for making them wait. They sat with their knees touching his metal desk and chatted about college life at Central. The office had no windows, and the thermostat seemed to be stuck on 80. Reading from a printout, the case manager went through a series of useless questions, most of which Samuel answered with either a yes or a no. Both answers pleased the man, and he made some important entries in the case file. 20 minutes after entering the office, they quickly left and hustled outside for fresh air. The entire meeting could have easily been handled over the phone or by email in less than 10 minutes. Miss Ida said, "They just wanted to lay eyes on you, that's all." Samuel preferred not to return to campus. The dorm was deserted and he had little to do. So Miss Ida bought him lunch at a diner and took him to work. She introduced him to some of her staff, then parked him at an old desk and handed him a stack of papers to sort out and file. Samuel happily removed his tie and got busy. Late in the afternoon, with Miss Ida tied up in meetings, Samuel left the office and enjoyed a long walk back to campus. The weather was clear and warmer, and the stroll lifted his spirits. He was excited because of the immigration meeting and knew that he was on his way to citizenship. When that was attained, he could take the next step toward rescuing his family. The gym was dark and empty, as was the rest of the campus. He had not seen another person moving around, not even a security guard. There was no traffic. All parking lots were empty. He changed in the locker room and hit the court. Central tipped off against Grambling at 8 p.m., and the game was on ESPNU. Though he had become bored with watching the games and not playing, Samuel was nonetheless excited to see his friends on television and playing on such a grand stage. A nice crowd was on hand, and the mood was festive. In his dorm room, Sully ate a pizza and yelled encouragement. Mitch Rocker, the senior point guard, got off to a strong start and hit his first 3 shots. Melvin Montgomery and Roy Tice clogged the lane on defense and smothered Grambling's big men. Murray entered the game at the 8-minute mark and immediately got a steal. The score was tied at halftime, and Central had played its best 20 minutes of the season. Vegas had the Eagles as 14-point dogs, but someone forgot to inform the players. As he flipped channels, there was a soft knock on his door. At first, he didn't believe it. He thought he was the only person on campus. After the second knock, he opened it and found Robin smiling at him.
"Hello, Sully. Can I come in?"
"Sure," he said.
thoroughly confused. She lived in Raleigh, had a car, and seemed to roam at will. She bounced on Murray's bed, her second home, and asked,
"Are you watching the game?"
"Of course I am."
"What are you doing out and about?"
"Just bored. Thought you might need some company."
Like every other co-ed, she lived on her cell phone, so why hadn't she called first? Could it be that she did not want to be told no? She was wearing tight jeans and a loose sweatshirt. She kicked off her shoes and wanted to chat. She was cute, sexy, vibrant, and seemed to enjoy making him uncomfortable. The girl got around. She was part of a group of fast women who hung out with the athletes, and Suli had heard some whispers in the locker room, something to the effect that perhaps she was well known to a few of the other players, and Miss Ida didn't like her at all. A clear omen that she was trouble. The second half began, and they focused on the game, urging on their team, yelling at the bad calls, celebrating the good shots. Grambling went to a 2-3 zone and shut down the middle. Central was not a great outside shooting team, and when Mitch Rocker and Duffy Sunday went cold, the game got away from them. During a timeout, Robin asked Suli who he was dating. She knew damned well he was not dating because Murray told her everything.
"Nobody," he admitted. "That's hard to believe. All the girls I know want to see you naked."
He laughed nervously. They were distracted for a moment when Murray entered the game at 7 minutes to go and Central down by 10. It seemed so wrong to be watching his best friend on television while his girlfriend put the moves on. Grambling won by 12. As soon as the game was over, Robin turned to him and asked,
"Want to fool around?"
Suli walked to the door, opened it, and nodded to the hallway.
"Not with my best friend's girl. Sorry."
"Come on, Suli. No one will ever know.
Please, get out of here."
Chapter 36. Robin texted him throughout the day and hinted that she might return to the dorm. Suli spent the day in the nest, alone, taking 1,000 shots, watching college and NBA games in the film room. He slept there, too, with the door locked. Prairie View beat Central by 8. On New Year's Eve, he walked half an hour to the Walker home and had dinner with the family. Afterward, they watched Central lose a well-played game to Fisk, a superior team. Murray played only 3 minutes in the first half, and his parents weren't happy about it. During the second half, Suli eased away from the tension and went downstairs to the basement to watch the game alone. Jordan followed him, and as they lost interest in the game, some serious flirting ensued. At first, Suli was delighted to get so much of her attention, but became rattled when she seemed more aggressive. However, Miss Ida smelled trouble and soon joined them. Suli was relieved, on the one hand. On the other, he had trouble sleeping on the sofa, his thoughts of nothing but Jordan's fine legs. The team arrived home on New Year's Day. The 3 losses were difficult to stomach, and Coach Britt was not happy. They practiced hard for 3 straight days, and on January the 5th beat a hapless Division III team by 20 points in front of fewer than 200 fans. Had their faithful already given up? It seemed so. And then there were 10. After the game, Darrell Compton, a reserve guard, sent an email to his teammates that read, "Hey guys, I just met with Coach Britt and informed him that I am leaving the team. I'm transferring to Pico Community College in Texas, where I'll be eligible to play immediately. I love you and wish you the best. Darrell." The news was surprising, but not shocking. Darrell had been saying too much in the locker room, and his dissatisfaction was well known. He would not be missed by the team. His departure left them with 8 players, plus Suli and the walk-on, who was seeing almost no action. Harry Greenwood was recovering from knee surgery, and Evan Tucker's elbow had not mended well. Murray was out with Robin and was not back at midnight. Suli went to sleep and was awakened shortly thereafter when his roommate made a noisy entrance and turned on the lights.
He was distraught and said he needed to talk to someone. When Sully could focus, he realized Murray's eyes were red.
"She broke up with me,"
he said, his voice hoarse and strained.
"What? She ditched me, just like that."
"Did she say why?"
"Of course she said why. We've been at it for the past 2 hours, since she found somebody else and wanted out. Said all sorts of crazy shit."
Sully suddenly had a knot in his stomach and was horrified that he might be the somebody else.
"I'm so sorry, Murray. I don't know what to say." "There's nothing to say, so just listen, okay? How could she do this to me? I love this girl, and I thought we were onto something great. And man, was she hot in bed. I mean, one minute we're doing great, and the next thing I know, she's found another man. I don't believe this."
He wiped his eyes and for a long time stared painfully at the floor, completely heartbroken. Timidly, Sully asked,
"Any idea who the other guy is?" "No, she was too chicken to tell me."
What a relief. Sully suspected that the truth was that Robin had slept with several athletes, and he was secretly thrilled that she was out of the picture. His best friend deserved better. Sully's phone buzzed quietly. He looked at the screen and was horrified to see a text from Robin.
"I still want to see you naked."
He put the phone under his pillow and stretched out on his bed.
Women.
Chapter 37. Conference play began in earnest with a short bus ride to Greensboro for a game against North Carolina A&T, Central's biggest rival. With the students still on break, the small gym was only half full and both teams were sluggish. Midway through the first half, Coach Britt yanked Duffy Sunday, a guard who'd thrown up four bricks, and replaced him with Murray. Still feeling jilted and with something to prove, he promptly stole a pass at the top of the key, sprinted to the rim, and finished with a rousing slam dunk. Sully had never seen him move so fast, and the play inspired the Eagles. The next trip down, he hit a long three and screamed at the bench. The team came to life and went on a 10-0 run that put them up by six at the half. A&T fell apart in the second half, primarily because Murray was all over the court. He played 27 minutes, led the team with 15 points, then led the singing all the way home. Late that night, in the dorm room, he called Ernie and they debriefed for half an hour. Their home opener was against Coppin State, Monday, January 11th. Miss Ida, Jordan, and Ernie arrived early and Sully visited with them in the stands before the game. They were excited because Murray would be starting. It was amazing how a little playing time could lift the spirits of parents. Miss Ida said,
"He's playing better because he got rid of that girl."
Ernie said,
"She was nothing but trouble, but he's playing because he deserves to play."
Sully offered no opinion on the girl. Robin had stopped texting and had probably moved on to her next victim. When it was time to get dressed, he hugged Jordan and said goodbye for a few months. She would leave the following day for law school. Murray gave them plenty to cheer about. He and Mitch Rocker controlled the backcourt and kept the pace a little slower, something Coach Britt had planned. Coppin State was small but fast and preferred to run, but struggled from the outside. Murray had three steals and six assists in the first half, and though he didn't score, he played 15 minutes. He had two bombs to start the second half, and the Eagles never looked back. 4 days later, the team left on a chartered flight to Tallahassee to play the Rattlers of Florida A&M. FAMU was a top preseason pick and had beaten Howard at home 4 days earlier. The Central coaches were hopeful that with two straight wins, the team had turned the corner and found some traction. The new lineup, with Murray at guard and Jabari Nix at forward, had looked unbeatable against Coppin State. FAMU was known for its aggressive man-to-man defense and surprised the Eagles by pressing full court from the opening tip-off. Murray and Mitch Rocker struggled to break the press, and the offense was out of sync. When they managed to cross midcourt, 10 seconds were gone, and they couldn't run their plays. FAMU jumped to an early lead and never slowed down. Flying home, Coach Britt checked the other scores from around the conference and saw what he expected but didn't like. Central was the first MEAC team to lose 10 games, and two of those teams,
Howard, and FAMU were even better than the experts had anticipated. At 6-10, with 14 conference games to go, he had the queasy feeling that his team was in free fall, and he wasn't sure how to save it. Once home, he shared a late-night pizza with his wife and three kids. He went to bed at 11, couldn't sleep, finally dozed off, and was awakened at 3:30 Sunday morning by a phone call from a student manager. Four of his players were running high fevers and showing flu-like symptoms. Lonnie called the team doctor and arranged for the sick players to go immediately to the student infirmary. He called the other coaches and told them to quarantine for 48 hours. It was too late for Jason Grinnell, who had a fever.
"That damned airplane was packed," Jason said.
Samuel's forehead was on fire, and he shook with the chills as Murray rushed him to the campus clinic. The flu test was positive. Murray called his mother, and she demanded that he bring Samuel home immediately. Murray wasn't sick yet, but the bug was racing through the campus, and she wanted him away from his teammates. She took Samuel to the basement, gave him his meds, turned out the lights, and told him to close his eyes. In her opinion, the best way to fight the flu was with plenty of liquids and hours of sleep. The chills and fevers continued throughout the night, and sleep was impossible. Down four players and one coach, Central hosted Morgan State the following Monday, and played like the entire team had been stricken with some awful virus. Morgan State was average, and their coach was clever. He heard the flu rumors, noticed only six Central players warming up, and quickly changed his game plan to an all-out run-and-gun, up-tempo horse race. It worked, and by halftime, the Eagles were dragging. Sully followed the game online, but felt so lousy, he really didn't care who won. Morgan State by 18. It was his fourth night in the dark basement, and he still felt like he'd been run over by a bus. He was tired of the fever, the headaches, the tomato soup. Frankly, he was tired of his nurse, who checked on him every half hour, it seemed. During the day, she called. Ernie called. Murray called. How was anybody supposed to sleep? Evidently, the strain that hit the campus was particularly virulent. Two of the four players, Roy Tice and Duffy Sunday, recovered enough to make the bus trip to Delaware State. Dimitri Robbins and Sully did not. Coach Grinnell stayed home, too, and it was just as well. Delaware State ran the Eagles out of the gym. 2 days later, the same bus hauled them back home after another bad game, another frustrating effort at South Carolina State. It was their 13th loss, fifth in the conference, and the mood could not have been darker. Coach Britt had stopped yelling. He had also stopped dreaming of a fine new job at a bigger school. At the moment, he was just hoping to keep the one he had. Chapter 38. After a week of quiet mornings, Lonnie unlocked his office door early Saturday and stopped when he heard a bouncing ball. Sully was back, and it was time for a chat. He watched him for a moment, then pulled him off the court. They sat in the empty stands as the first rays of sunlight peeked through the windows and scattered on the floor.
"The doctor says you're good to go," Lonnie said.
"I'm okay, coach. It was a long week, but I'm over it."
"How much weight did you lose?"
10 pounds. Already putting it back on.
"Are you weak?"
"I'm about 90%, coach, and getting stronger every day."
"Do you think you're ready to play?"
"Sure. I mean, you're talking about a real game?"
"Maybe, yes. I hate to burn your red shirt year, Sully, and I won't do it if you object, but the truth has become rather obvious, hasn't it? We need some help. We need a new lineup. Maybe we need new coaches. I don't know. I'm afraid the players are on the verge of giving up."
"I'm ready, coach. It sucks being a red shirt. All the practice and none of the games. When do you want me?"
"I'm not sure. We play here tomorrow afternoon. Should be an easy game, but nothing is coming easy these days. Ronte's out sick. You get mentally prepared and stay ready, okay?"
"Got it, coach. Just put me in.
The very thought of getting into a real game for the first time since August, and his first college game at that, sent Samuel into orbit. He shot baskets with a new determination, and he did so for the rest of the morning. When he left the gym in search of food, a light snow was falling. He took it as a good omen, his first snow, the day before his first game. There was little accumulation, and the streets, though unplowed, remained passable. Still, venturing out on a raw, cold Sunday afternoon to watch two teams with losing records was not appealing to many fans. Months later, thousands would claim to have been there for his first game, but the number was closer to 500. The opponent was Maryland Eastern Shore. The teams were evenly matched and swapped baskets for the first 10 minutes. Just before the half, Roy Tice picked up his third foul, and a minute later, Dimitri Robbins did the same. During the break, Coach McCoy whispered to Sully to get ready. At 6:20, Tice was whistled on a terrible call, one so bad that Lonnie lost his cool and drew his second technical of the season. Enter Samuel Suleiman, with a knot in his stomach so large he at first had trouble breathing. To settle his nerves, he sprinted down the court on defense and deliberately ran into his man. The contact felt good. Then he lost him and watched as he hit a wide-open jumper. Coach Britt yelled, "Relax, Sully!" He tried to relax, tried to keep up with his man on defense, tried to remember the plays on offense, and really didn't want the ball. He was in the lane when their point guard drove hard to the rim and tossed up a floater. Sully sprang from nowhere and slapped the ball out of bounds. Seconds later, his man shot a jumper from the free throw line, and Sully slapped it over the press table. The slapping and blocking was great fun, and the central bench came to life. Sully's first bucket was a perfect alley-oop from Murray, a play they had toyed with in practice. Eye contact, a quick hand signal from Murray, a sprint to the rim, a highlight reel slam. Once he was sweating, Sully realized his nerves had settled. He could play this game. The man guarding him was only 6'4", much too short to bother him. He took a pass from Murray, dribbled to the top of the key, and launched himself high into the air. The jump shot was perfect form, but the ball bounced off the rim. He finished the first half without scoring again. The Eagles led by 8, and the locker room was jazzed. After losing 4 straight conference games, the team was determined to win. The legend of Sully began with 15 minutes to go in the second half. He entered the game for Dimitri at strong forward and set up low. Murray lost the ball, clawed it back, bounced it to Mitch Rocker, who had it slapped away. A scramble ensued as players on both teams dived for the ball. It squirted free from the scrum, and Sully scooped it up in midcourt with 2 seconds on the shot clock. Without hesitation, he sprang high and aimed at the rim. It was not a hopeless effort to beat the buzzer. It was not a Hail Mary. Instead, it was a smooth, confident, perfect jump shot from 42 feet that found nothing but net. The central bench went nuts. The small crowd screamed as Sully backed away, skipping in celebration and smiling, always smiling. He glanced at Coach Britt, who stood frozen, his mouth wide open. He managed to nod as if to say, "Do it again." The game was not being televised, but every game was filmed, and the shot was duly recorded. A manager would post it later, and it made the rounds. Melvin Montgomery, the junior center, grabbed a rebound and bounced the ball to Mitch Rocker, who took his time and set up the offense. Sully shoved his man, peeled off a screen, and popped open deep in a corner. Mitch got the ball to him, and he went up, far above his struggling defender, and launched one from 30 feet. Nothing but net. A minute later, he hit his third straight bomb, and Eastern Shore called time to regroup. The short break didn't help. Sully missed his next one, then faked his man out of his shoes and drove hard for a dunk.
"Get the ball to Sully,"
Lonnie hissed at Mitch as he dribbled by. The play was designed for Sully to spin off a screen and take a bounce pass and then shoot off the catch. He did, and jumped high over their center for an easy shot. With his height and amazing leap, his release was level with the basket, and he seemed unstoppable. Sully finished the game with 17 points in 14 minutes, plus 6 rebounds, 2 blocks, and 2 steals. The locker room was crazy as his teammates and managers, even the coaches, celebrated their new star and a new season. Early Wednesday morning, Sully was in the gym, sitting high in the stands and waiting for the call from Christine Moran. He couldn't wait to tell his mother and brothers about the game, but the call never came. He tried calling Christine's cell, but there was no answer, no service. That had happened before, and he wasn't worried. His family was safe and fed, and the boys were in school, so little else mattered. On his phone, he scrolled through the collection of photos Echo had taken at Rhino Camp, and he watched the video of Beatrice and his brothers speaking into the camera and excitedly asking him questions about his new life. He had watched it 100 times, and it always made him laugh and cry. He turned on the lights and began shooting. Bethune-Cookman was 12-8, with only 2 losses in conference. The Vegas odds makers had him at 13-point favorites, even on the road, and they took the floor with some swagger. The Nest had 3,500 seats and was almost full. The student section was packed and loud. Sully didn't start, but came off the bench at 6 minutes and couldn't wait to get the ball. Too eager, he put up a long brick, but followed it with the rebound, which he fired down low to Roy Tice for an easy dunk that tied the score. On the next trip down, he landed a hard elbow in the kidney of his defender, bounced off, took a pass from Murray, and leaped toward the ceiling with a gorgeous shot that caught nothing but net. It was the first 3 of the game for Central, the first of many. In practice, and firing away with the confidence of a real gunner, he was now unstoppable from long range. The coaches had decided to turn him loose with a standing green light. The old offense had sputtered badly. Why not build a new one around Sully? When he hit his 3rd bomb, Bethune called time. Their best defender was a 6'5 small forward with lightning quick hands. He dogged Sully from midcourt on as the rest of the defense waited to collapse on him. Sully loved a great pass more than a long basket, and he began dishing off to his open teammates. With all 5 scoring, Central ripped off a 14-0 run and led by 15 at the half. Sully re-entered the game with 16 minutes to go and quickly hit a 30-footer. He was 5-for-8 from long range. The next time down, there were 2 defenders waiting on him, and that made him smile. Everything made him smile. With so much attention, he decided to stay far away from the basket and smiled as Murray and Mitch Rocker slashed through the lane, often dishing off to Roy Tice for easy baskets. When the defense retreated to protect the lane, Sully was more than ready to bomb away. Everything worked, and Central routed Bethune by 20, scoring a season-high 92 points. Sully had 24, as did Roy Tice. Sully also grabbed 11 rebounds for his first double-double. 5 days later, Central easily beat Norfolk State on the road for its 3rd straight win. Sully scored 20 and blocked 7 shots. Chapter 39. Coach Jason Grinnell's brother, Hubert, had played at Duke and was now an assistant coach. As he did several times each season, Hubert arranged some passes for his brother, who brought a few of his players for a game at Cameron Indoor. On a Sunday afternoon, Jason drove Murray, Sully, and Harry Greenwood to Duke for a nationally televised game against Louisville. Duke was undefeated at 22-0 and had been number 1 since long before the season started. Louisville was ranked 4th and had lost only twice. They arrived early and walked through the tent city, where students who were paying $50,000 a year in tuition camped out for days to get tickets. It was an impressive sight, and Sully could not help but think of his mother and brothers living in a tent for months now, a tent they were lucky to have, but with no idea how long they would have it. Inside, they toured the Duke Basketball Museum and Athletics Hall of Fame, a plush addition to Cameron. It was filled with trophies of Duke's 5 national titles and bronze busts of their great All-Americans, Johnny Dawkins, Mike Jaminski, Christian Leitner, Grant Hill, Jay Williams, Shane Battier. There were plenty of them. There were highlights on large screens and interactive videos. Hubert welcomed them and showed them around. He led them to the court, named for Coach K, and pointed to dozens of championship banners and retired jerseys hanging from the ceiling. The student section was already packed, and the crazies were roaring an hour before the game. Sully, who had played in the Amway Center in Orlando, was surprised by the coziness of Cameron Indoor. Hubert laughed and told the familiar story of the time when Duke wanted to build a 20,000-seat palace to honor its coach, but Kay said no. Cameron was good for at least a 10-point advantage against any opponent. Its 9,300 crazed fans could make more noise than any crowd twice its size. Every opposing player would admit privately to some level of intimidation. Their seats were two rows behind the Duke bench, close enough to almost touch the Blue Devil players. They watched the pregame warm-ups in awe as Cameron rocked with excitement. The four NBA-bound freshmen, Kevin Washington, Tyrell Miller, Akeem Akhman, and Darnell Coe, were all scoring and rebounding in double figures, and the pundits were discussing whether there was room for all of them on the first-team All-American. Another favorite argument was which one would go highest in the draft, but there was little doubt they were all first-rounders. Sully watched them with admiration and no small amount of envy. They were his age, had already attained the status of greatness, and would soon be wealthy stars. Though the nest was only 2.9 miles away, it was in another world. The game lived up to its hype. Both teams were loaded with talent and superbly coached, and they played to a draw in the first half. In the second, Duke's deep bench became a factor as its relentless defense wore down the Cardinals. With 6 minutes to go, the inevitable happened. Duke's long-range bombers got hot. For this game, it was Tyrell Miller and Darnell Coe, and they buried Louisville with a barrage of threes. The crowd got even louder, and at times, Sully couldn't hear himself think. He would never forget the experience. He loved the spectacle, the action, the back and forth of two great teams, but he was also convinced that he belonged on that court. It was time to step up his game. And he wasn't alone. Though Hubert had yet to tell his brother, he and another Duke assistant had begun quiet discussions about approaching Sully with the idea of a transfer. They had heard the rumors, watched some film, and planned to sneak into the nest for a game. If they became convinced, they would broach the subject with Coach K. Driving home, with their ears still ringing, Coach Grinnell entertained them with the story of his first and only game at Cameron. He had played for 4 years at Wofford, and in what was scheduled to be one of those early December cakewalks, his team had fought Duke to a tie in regulation, then lost by 3 in overtime. He had missed a 30-footer at the buzzer, a shot that he should have made, and one that would haunt him for the rest of his life. It was snowing again when they returned to their campus, the other school in Durham. Howard rolled into town, leading the MEAC with only one loss and playing well. Vegas thought they should win by 9. Coach Britt mentioned this to his team in the locker room and, of course, reminded them of the egg they had laid in Washington on December 19th, an embarrassing loss by 31, and it was time for revenge. 3 straight conference wins, along with the emergence of a freshman star, and the crowds were growing. The nest was near capacity when the teams took the floor, and the Central students were in a raucous mood. The frigid temperature outside seemed to affect both teams, and neither scored in the first 2 minutes. At 15:20, and with only 4 points on the board, Coach Britt called time and put in Sully and Jabari Nix. When Jabari missed a 10-foot jumper, the rebound went long and Howard broke fast. As its point guard sailed in for an easy layup, Sully sprang from what seemed like midcourt, slapped the ball hard against the backboard, then grabbed the rebound and rifled a pass to Melvin Montgomery, who was trailing badly. He walked the ball to the rim and slammed it home. A replay would show that Sully's block was goaltending, but the refs had been too stunned to call it. The Howard coach was livid, wouldn't back down, and finally, the refs had no choice but to tee him up. As Mitch Rocker took the penalty shot, the Central students began, loudly, "Sully! Sully! Sully!" On the inbound, Sully made eye contact with Murray, who had the ball, and broke for the corner. Murray's pass was perfect, and before any Howard player could react, Sully was soaring toward the roof from 30 feet with a perfect jumper. He followed it with 2 more from long range, and the windows in the old gym were rattling. As a rookie, Sully was aware of the protocol, and the last thing he wanted was loose talk in the locker room, the kind of tension created by a freshman hotshot who hogged the ball. He passed up a good look and fired a beautiful pass to Roy Tice, who lost it out of bounds. As the clock ticked, it became apparent that none of his teammates could buy a basket. Howard was tall and tough inside and gave up nothing. No problem. Sully backed away, peeled off a screen, and hit his fourth straight from beyond the arc. He missed his next two and began passing. At 3:35, he came out for a breather and watched Howard go up by six. With a minute to go in the half, Roy Tice, a real banger inside, picked up his third foul and Lonnie yanked him. Down by three and with the ball, Murray killed some clock and set up the last play. His pass was slapped away and rolled to Sully, who was almost at midcourt. His defender backed away, daring him to shoot. And with 8 seconds to go, he did. Wide open, he skied anyway and lofted a beautiful shot that tied the score. The crowd roared even louder, and the team hustled to the locker room with the chant of "Sully, Sully, Sully" in the background. He had 14 points, 4 threes, and a dunk. He was the offense, and at that moment, his teammates were willing to put the game on his back. So were the coaches. They huddled away from the players and agreed on the strategy. Just get the damned ball to Sully. All eyes were on him as he sat on the bench for the first three very long minutes of the second half. When Coach Britt called his name and he walked to the scorer's table, the crowd reacted. So did Howard, but it was impossible to defend a long jump shot cocked high above the head of a 6'7 player who could spring over the backboard. He hit two of them, missed the third, and when he hit his third and seventh out of nine, Howard called time. Their coach decided that the only way to stop him was to foul, and hard. Sully spent most of the second half at the free throw line, calmly making 10 out of 12. He finished the game with 39, half the team's total, and the third most in school history. Howard, humbled, limped home with a 12-point loss. Late that night in their dorm room, Sully and Murray had a delightful time on social media. The Central faithful were lighting it up. Girls were calling and leaving all manner of messages. Sully's phone number was out there, and the texts poured in by the dozens. On Friday, February 12th, the Eagles missed classes and rode the bus 5 hours to Baltimore. At 1 o'clock the following day, they defeated Coppin State by 18 points. Sully, still coming off the bench but playing 29 minutes, scored 31 and blocked 4 shots. They spent 2 more nights in Baltimore, and on Monday, beat Morgan State by 15 in a wild shootout. The Eagles put up 98 points, 36 by Sully. Back home the following Saturday, they beat South Carolina State by 14 in front of a standing-room-only crowd. The win, their 7th straight, evened their record at 13-13. Though there was now talk of playing in March, they were well aware that their slow start would be hard to overcome. Coach Britt gave them Sunday off, but wanted them to report to the gym anyway. The team doctor had ordered routine physicals. Sully weighed in at 227 and measured 6'7½", still growing. The team's press guide, printed the previous November, listed him at 6'6", 210 pounds. The next day, Murray showed him how to change his phone number.